the prospect of developing and commanding an expanded, technically cutting-edge army. The Nazis' espousal of all things military and the fact that their own leadership numbered so many war veterans also helped them win the approval of many Frontkämpfer among the senior officer corps. Harder to convince were the older, most senior officers, such as General of Infantry Gerd von Rundstedt and Lieutenant General Fedor von Bock. Such men belonged to that group born between the mid-1870s and mid-1880s, who had served mainly as staff officers during the First World War. As a socially homogeneous group, hailing predominantly from aristocratic Prussian stock, they held the officer corps' traditionally conservative attitudes. They longed for Germany to regain its great power status, but were deeply uneasy about the Nazi movement's revolutionary elements. On the other hand, they tended from the start to blame the regime's early excesses on extreme Nazi elements, rather than on Hitler. Moreover, older officers, like many of their younger colleagues, already widely shared Nazi ideology's disdain for Slavs, Bolsheviks, and Jews, even if they felt it less intensely than the Nazis themselves did. When in February 1933, and again in February 1934, Hitler conveyed to the army's most senior officers his long-term ambition of waging a racial war in the East, they did not take his utterances especially seriously. Major General Maximilian Freiherr von Feichs would go on to command army groups in southern Russia and the Balkans during the Second World War. He transcribed Hitler's words at the February 1934 meeting, later recalling, "The soldier was used to taking a politician's words not entirely seriously. To justify his political aims, he often selects aspects that don't correspond to his true intentions." But neither did the generals recoil from the vision Hitler was presenting to them. According to Weichs, these sinister intimations were probably soon forgotten, and the officer corps as a whole did believe the Nazi regime would infuse the German people with the unified militaristic spirit that it would need to stay the course in a future war. Hitler also directed at the officer corps copious rhetoric about the army being the second pillar of the new Nazi state alongside the Nazi Party. Officers lapped this up, acceded to a process that would in fact see the army increasingly subordinated to the Nazi regime. The officer corps deluded themselves all the more easily because of the resources showered upon the army and upon the armed forces generally during the regime's early years. The first key announcement as to how much cash was to be allocated to rearmament seems to have come in June 1933. The annual allocation of about 4.4 billion Reichsmarks eclipsed the hundreds of millions the Weimar Republic had spent annually, and 4.4 billion Reichsmarks was just the start. In 1935, the armed forces' share of government expenditure rose to 73%. Big business bought into the Nazi economic program, albeit with some reservations, partly because rearmament promised enormous profits and business opportunities, partly because the Nazis had obligingly destroyed the trade unions, and partly because the Nazis were able to manipulate big business by divide and rule, particularly co-opting those sections of commerce and industry that had most to gain from rearmament. Initially, rearmament was to be financed secretly through loans granted by the various large companies that stood to gain from it. Blomberg was allowed to bypass the finance ministry, present his demands to a three-man committee, and, if he did not get his way, go straight to Hitler. The regime also spent far more on rearmament than on civilian work creation schemes. Even ostensibly non-military projects had a military use. For instance, the new network of Autobahnen, motorways, on which work commenced soon after the Nazis assumed power, would be able to convey 300,000 troops from east to west within 2 days. From March 1935, Hitler would stop rearming secretly and announce his intentions openly. Meanwhile, the Nazi movement faced an internal power struggle, one that would entangle and then taint the army leadership. The struggle was between the leadership of the SA, particularly Chief of Staff Ernst Röhm, on the one hand, and the army leadership, other conservative elites and Röhm's rivals in the Nazi movement, on the other. The stormtroopers' thuggery towards the Nazis' opponents had been immensely useful when the Nazis were campaigning for power. Now that they had reached their goal, however, the stormtroopers were becoming a lawless, destabilizing element on German streets. The National Conservative bloc, to which the army leadership belonged, was generally unconcerned if the SA assaulted communists, socialists, and Jews. But their rowdiness threatened to get out of hand and destabilize German commerce and local government. The SA leadership, stressing the social in National Socialism, was also calling for radically redistributive economic measures. This undermined Hitler's appeal to the conservative elites on whose support and expertise he extensively relied during the Nazis' early period in power. As far as the Reichswehr in particular was concerned, Röhm called for the SA to be absorbed into it. This would not only fully militarize the much larger SA, but also enable it virtually to swallow up the Reichswehr. Hitler was well aware of how much this prospect alarmed the Reichswehr leadership, and this was an elite whose professionalism Hitler badly needed if he were to realize his military and foreign policy goals. Many officers with socially conservative views commonplace in the West during the 1930s also deplored the open homosexuality of Röhm and other SA leaders. This concern, however, was secondary to the power political danger the SA posed. Relations between the two organizations were not entirely antagonistic. Many middle-ranking army officers enjoyed good working relations with senior SA men, who were mostly ex-soldiers themselves, over matters of training and border security. Overall, however, the Reichswehr leadership regarded the SA with palpable alarm, and as a menace, if not to its own existence, then certainly to its power position in matters of national defense. The key individual in Röhm's eventual downfall was Heinrich Himmler. Himmler commanded the Schutzstaffel, the SS. The SS had been founded in 1925, essentially as Hitler's personal bodyguard, or Leibstandarte. So loyal did it prove to Hitler that, on the Nazis' assumption of power, he expanded his bodyguard to regimental size as the Leibstandarte Adolf Hitler, or LAH. That same year, further SS units raised as guards for the new concentration camps were organized into Totenkopf, Death's Head units. Then, in 1934, three regiments of special service troops, the SS-Verfügungstruppe, or SSVT, were raised to suppress internal insurrections. Both they and the LAH were fitted out as motorized infantry. Eventually, they would form the nucleus of the mechanized divisions of the Waffen-SS, literally Weapons SS. In 1934, meanwhile, the SSVT would play a key role in removing Röhm and his colleagues. Himmler, though technically subordinate to Röhm, sought to discredit him in Hitler's eyes and advance his own ambitions by claiming that Röhm was plotting a coup against Hitler. Given that Hitler was anxious to retain the conservatives' support and aware of their antipathy towards the SA, Himmler was to some extent pushing at an open door. For his part, Blomberg told Hitler that if he did not restore order and bring the SA back under control, President Hindenburg would declare martial law. To give such demands more traction, Reichswehr intelligence uncovered an order from Röhm for arming the SA in preparation for an attack on the army. On the night of 30 June 1934, Röhm and other SA leaders were seized by the SS, then murdered either on the spot or over the following days. The purge, known as the Night of the Long Knives, also wiped out numerous other real or imagined opponents and critics of Hitler's leadership. Two former generals, Kurt von Schleicher, Hitler's predecessor as Chancellor, and his aide, Major General Ferdinand von Bredow, were among the slain. These particular killings appalled many army officers. For Captain Henning von Treskow, the affair strengthened his growing disgust at the Nazi regime, a disgust that had already been brewing with the regime's assault on the German constitution and its undermining of the churches. But other officers, satisfied that the SA had been neutralized, kept their disgust private. Reichenau exploited this sentiment in guidelines for the Reichswehr's political instruction, issued in 1934, which proclaimed, "The Reich Chancellor kept his word when he nipped in the bud Röhm's attempt to incorporate the SA into the Reichswehr. We love him because he has shown himself a true soldier." Blomberg now directed the army's troops to view SS men as comrades. At the same time, Himmler was using the power vacuum created by the Night of the Long Knives to buttress the power base of the SS, extend its control to the state's political forces, and build up the already existing SS formations as the nucleus of the future Waffen-SS, a body that would eventually rival the army for control of military manpower and resources. Blomberg, in his capacity as Minister for War, now authorized numerous measures that aided and abetted this process. Among other things, he gave his approval for the Totenkopf formations to become a division in the event of war. By contrast, the leadership of the army itself tried to delay the development of militarized SS units, restrict the expansion of their training, and retain overall control over them. It got its way, but only temporarily. In other respects, both Blomberg and the army leadership further rewarded the faith Hitler was placing in them. Following President Hindenburg's death in August 1934, Hitler merged the offices of Chancellor and State President into the new office of Führer. Blomberg and the Reichenau now devised an oath of loyalty for the troops to swear to Hitler personally. Though Fritsch and Beck had deep misgivings about subordinating the army to Hitler to this extent, the great majority of officers readily acquiesced in it. The oath exemplified how far the military leadership was increasingly prepared to identify itself with the Nazi regime as it sought to consolidate its own position in the new Reich. On the swearing of the oath, Colonel General Wilhelm Heyer, a former Reichswehr army head, proclaimed, "Adolf Hitler has given us the most soldierly state, a united German Wehrmacht, armed forces, without territorial boundaries, and with the unified army, a unified Luftwaffe, and a unified navy." After 1945, many former officers would claim that the obligation under which the oath had placed them, and its appeal to their sense of soldierly honor, had prevented them from acting independently of or against the Nazi regime. "The oath of allegiance was not something we had learned to play fast and loose with," maintained Erich von Manstein. Yet there is a healthy cynicism in suspecting that at least some officers only discovered this moral dilemma after 1945 so as to justify their earlier inaction. The army leadership was also increasingly dazzled by the military possibilities now opening up. In the spring of 1935, the entire army underwent its single most radical transformation under the Third Reich. Hitler publicly declared he was ending the Versailles armaments restrictions, reintroducing conscription, and founding a new and expanded army, navy, and air force under the collective name of the Wehrmacht. Among other things, Hitler announced that he intended to build a peacetime force of 36 divisions, a fivefold increase in the army's size. The great majority of the new divisions would be infantry divisions. As the army continuously expanded and reorganized over the years before and throughout the war, its infantry divisions would be categorized in different waves. First wave divisions would comprise the army's active peacetime infantry divisions, and would be the most formidable in terms of manpower and equipment. Divisions in successive waves were less generously furnished on both scores. Moreover, their manpower largely comprised different types of reservist of varying degrees of quality. From the start, however, the most important and formidable element of all in the army's evolution would be its armored force. Not only the army's composition was transformed, but also its character. A peacetime expansion to 36 divisions, even without the army's likely wartime manpower needs, meant that neither the new army nor its officer corps could remain the socially selective, technocratic institution of the Weimar years. This, Hitler declared, was to be a true people's army, representing all sectors of German society. A particularly pressing challenge was finding enough suitable officer material. A flood of young recruits and older reactivated officers now entered the corps. Moreover, during 1935 and 1936, 56,000 policemen joined the Wehrmacht, 1,200 of them as officers. This measure increasingly blurred the distinction between army and SS, as the latter achieved full control of Germany's police forces between 1934 and 1936. Himmler's control over the German police force was formalized in June 1936. Hitler augmented his title as head of the SS to appoint him Reichsführer SS und Chef der Deutschen Polizei. From then on, the SS and police was officially one organization. The army also endeavored to recruit officers from among higher-level school students, capitalizing on Nazi ideology's saturation of the school curriculum. In the later words of Major General Hans Friesner, the army's inspector of education and training, The Wehrmacht has not just the right, but also the duty to align all educational and training methods with its demands, and thereby secure the best degree of military power. Nevertheless, the Army's recruitment efforts in schools were initially ad hoc. Their most pressing concern was simply to pack as many new recruits into the officer corps as possible. Despite all these measures, the Army remained under-officered when it went to war, a deficiency that would worsen as the war continued. The vast new intake transformed the officer corps' social makeup. Between 1928 and 1930, nearly two-thirds of officer candidates still originated from the officer corps' favored aristocratic and upper-middle-class circles. The new officer corps did not entirely embody the People's Army of Nazi rhetoric. Between 1939 and 1941, men from aristocratic and upper-middle-class backgrounds comprised a quarter of all candidates. As a proportion of the population, then, they were still overrepresented. But the officer corps certainly reflected the entire swath of the German middle and upper classes more than before. In particular, the 1939 to 1941 period saw men from extensively pro-Nazi white-collar families rise from a third to 54% of all candidates. Though the working class was largely absent, rapidly mounting wartime casualties would eventually change that. But by the late 1930s, any distinctive, long-established officer ethos was already disappearing. Instead, the Wehrmacht and army leadership sought to ingrain officers and men with a new mentality befitting an army that supposedly embodied the new community to which all politically and racially acceptable Germans were deemed to belong. During 1935 and 1936, the Wehrmacht produced numerous publications intended to inculcate officers and men with the importance of the military and political tasks that faced them. It was Blomberg, again, who played the largest role. In July 1936, he ordered that any politically unreliable officer be reported to the Gestapo. He assisted the Nazi attack on organized religion by making church services for the troops optional instead of compulsory. Jews were to be excluded from the officer corps and the army, and Blomberg also banned soldiers from marrying non-Aryan women or patronizing Jewish warehouses and shops. But Blomberg's perhaps most far-reaching measure came on 30 January 1936, the third anniversary of the Nazis' accession to power, when he ordered officer colleges and academies to devote at least 2 hours per month to national political teaching. Officers down to company level were to take direct responsibility for such teaching, and also to convey to their men the importance of the unity and community of soldiery and National Socialist ideology. Yet only in the final years of the war would the Wehrmacht seek to instill a spirit of true ideological fanaticism into its troops. In 1935, by contrast, Hitler declared himself not concerned that the recruits coming in turn the soldiers into National Socialists, but that the army turn the National Socialists coming into it into soldiers. Therein, however, lay the rub. For many of the ordinary Germans who were coming into the army had reason to feel less than effusive about the Nazi regime. It is always difficult to find reliable measures of public opinion under a dictatorship. Nevertheless, the morale reports of the Reich Security Service, Sicherheitsdienst, or SD, as well as from the Social Democratic Party of Germany, Sozialdemokratische Partei Deutschlands, or SPD, and other non-Nazi organizations in exile, together helped to build a semi-reliable picture. Although unemployment largely disappeared under the Nazis, Germans in the main did not feel a surge in personal prosperity, because the German economy's overwhelming focus on rearmament limited families' access not just to consumer goods, but also to foodstuffs and essentials. Many lower-middle-class Germans were disgruntled when the Nazis reneged on their pre-1933 promise to break up large department stores in favor of small businesses, and rural Germans were aggrieved when the regime similarly abandoned a pledge to redistribute agricultural land. Many workers resented, at least initially, the destruction of the trade unions and the suppression of wage increases. Religiously minded Germans, particularly Catholics, railed at Nazi attacks on freedom of worship, and Germans across the social spectrum widely despised the arrogance, incompetence, and corruption of local Nazi party officials. Quite apart from anything else, from German unification through the Imperial and Weimar eras, Germans had continued to feel a strong sense of local and regional identity, of Heimat. How a local or regional community's social and religious composition broke down, then, was something that might make it more receptive to Nazism, or, by the same token, less receptive. Either way, there was a limit to how far the Nazis were able to beget a true uniform spirit of Volksgemeinschaft among the German people. There was, therefore, also a limit to how Nazified the army's new recruits were likely to be. Even so, it would be nonsense to conclude that 1930s Nazi Germany was essentially a nation of unenthused grumblers. The disturbing truth is that Nazism integrated Germans much more than it alienated them. This, in turn, assured the army a flood of recruits who, though they might not be fanatical hardcore Nazis in the main, were well disposed towards the worldview the Nazis propagated and ready to take up arms in its cause. Pernicious anti-Semitism was widespread in the West during the interwar years, but in Germany, partly because of developments during and immediately after the First World War, it was more pronounced than in numerous other countries. Mainstream Germans may not have felt as intensely anti-Semitic as the Nazis, but the Nazis did persuade more than enough Germans during the 1930s that there was indeed a Jewish problem, even if most Germans preferred to see it solved by legislative discrimination rather than brutal terror. Many officers who had hitherto served with the police held authoritarian attitudes strongly in tune with Nazi values. More generally, Nazi policies provided plenty for which the bulk of mainstream Germans were grateful. The ordered state of German society following the chaos of the late Weimar years and the restoration of full employment were successes that the Nazis trumpeted to the utmost via their propaganda machine. Even though the Nazis could not rightly claim full credit for this state of affairs, and full employment was not accompanied by significant wage rises, most ordinary Germans felt personally and economically safer under the Nazis than under Weimar. Mass propaganda media, the education system, youth groups, and services in the RAD all combined to instill a feel-good attitude based upon this sense of security, together with messages of national pride, unity, and purpose. Furthermore, discriminating against Jews and against social and political undesirables made mainstream Germans feel more integrated. Those Germans who met the right social, political, and, above all, racial criteria could feel part of a national community and enjoy far greater self-confidence than they had a few years previously. In the words of Zönke Neitzel and Harald Welzer, "It is no accident that Germans of that generation tend to describe the Third Reich, up until Germany's military defeat at Stalingrad, as a great time." Such people were categorically incapable of experiencing the exclusion, persecution, and dispossession of others for what they were. This attitude did not condition people to wish genocide on the Jews or any other group, but it did help to numb ordinary Germans during the 1930s to the discrimination and persecution inflicted upon out-groups. These groups comprised Jews, most prominently, but also religious and political dissidents and an array of supposed social deviants, including juvenile delinquents, homosexuals, prostitutes, alcoholics, travellers, the homeless, and the work-shy. Among Germans who went on to serve in the Wehrmacht, it would not be too much of a leap to argue that being harshly disposed towards such groups and numb to their suffering might beget a similar attitude towards civilians in at least some parts of occupied Europe during the war itself. There is also every reason to suppose that German youth tended to be more receptive than older age groups to National Socialist messages. This, of course, would have a direct effect upon the main influx of recruits into the army. Depending on their particular age, most of the army's young new recruits during the Third Reich would already have undergone ideological and militaristic programming in schools, the Hitler Youth Movement, and the RAD. The Hitler Youth, which comprised the Deutsche Jungvolk for boys aged between 10 and 14, and then the Hitler Jugend, the Hitler Youth proper, for those aged up to 18, also provided boys with activities such as hiking, camping, and orienteering. Such activities, as well as being enjoyable in their own right, enabled German boys to become physically fit and acquire a range of practical skills applicable to soldiering. Just as importantly, the Hitler Youth sought to infuse its members with a strong sense of comradeship. As one former Hitler Youth leader recalled after the war, I was full of enthusiasm when I joined the Jungfolk at the age of 10. What boy isn't fired by being presented with high ideals such as comradeship, loyalty, and honour? In June 1934, an informer for the SPD in exile described the attitude of German youth. The drill, the uniform, the camp life, the fact that school and the parental home take second place behind the community of the young, all this is wonderful. Great times without danger. Many believed that economic paths have opened to them due to the persecution of Jews and Marxists. The RAD was designed to toughen and socialize boys further, weed out any lingering bookish tendencies within them, and set them to providing a practical service for the Reich by working on motorway construction and other public works schemes. The RAD made heavy physical demands on its members. Friedrich Gruppe recalled, "Early in the morning at 4 a.m. out of bed to a long cross-country run with early morning exercise, then washing up, breakfast, ceremonial raising of the flag, and already by 5 a.m. marching to the labor site in work overalls with spades at our shoulders." The RAD also aimed to strengthen character, comradeship, and cohesion further, and indeed to replicate the Volksgemeinschaft in microcosm. Gruppe wrote in his diary in 1937, "We're putting our conception of National Socialism into action. We are all the same in our service for the people. No one has asked his origins or class, whether he is rich or poor." There were also specialist organizations to which many German youths belonged, such as the National Socialist Motor Vehicle Corps, Nationalsozialistischer Kraftfahrkorps, or NSKK, which prepared them for future service in particular branches of the Wehrmacht. Further, the very fact that the Wehrmacht existed buttressed the Nazi regime's popularity among the general public, and consequently among the army's new recruits. When Hitler announced conscription, SPD informants noted the widespread enthusiasm this prompted, particularly among the young. Conscription appealed to the militaristic attitudes that much of the public had harbored during as well as before the Weimar years. It also appealed to the view that it does the young fellows no harm if once again they get knocked into shape, as SPD informants in Bavaria put it. It was also another sign that Germany had returned to the ranks of the great powers. From 1934 onwards, the Nazi Party's annual Nuremberg rally included a Day of the Wehrmacht, featuring enormous parades and displays of military equipment. Skilled workers felt considerable pride over the armaments they were producing. This was also a further means of cementing the bond between troops and people. As a wartime Panzer manual asserted, "For every shell you fire, your father has paid 100 Reichsmarks in taxes, your mother has worked for a week in the factory." Nazi propaganda minister Josef Goebbels further promoted the Wehrmacht's image with a sustained campaign of positive press coverage. At the heart of all this was the figure of Hitler himself. Nazi propaganda ascribed to him almost superhuman powers and created a potent Hitler myth in the process. It successfully credited him with all the regime's purported social and economic achievements and promoted a personal image that enabled him to avoid blame for all the defects of the regime that the German public identified. The deeply integrating effect Hitler would come to have upon many ordinary Germans would reach its zenith in the wake of Germany's lightning victory over France in 1940, but the groundwork was laid during the early to mid-1930s. Regardless of which branch of the army soldiers were eventually selected for, their raising and training was the task in the first instance of the replacement army, Ersatzheer. The basic operational unit of the army was the division. This was the lowest level of formation that was capable of independent operational-level combat activity, encompassing as it did combat troops, communications troops, and support services. Each of the new army's divisions contained a replacement battalion that directly undertook the training of new recruits. These were then transferred to a march battalion, which was responsible in turn for transferring them to their parent division. Upon arrival at their parent division, the men of the march battalion were distributed across the various regiments. This was also a regionally based system. Reich territory was organized into military districts, Wehrkreise. Divisions were raised within particular Wehrkreise, and their troops could thus expect to go on to serve alongside comrades from the same region as themselves. The system was also designed to ensure that, come wartime, soldiers who were wounded were returned to their old units once they had convalesced. Indeed, each division had its own convalescent home. Because this system was regionally based, it made army units considerably more cohesive. The new army retained the Reichswehr's intensive approach to training. Recruits first completed 16 weeks of basic training under the replacement battalion. Physical standards were exacting, army training particularly priding itself on getting troops to march long distances with full kit. Some training depots took things to extremes. There was nothing unique about a training program that sought to dehumanize recruits in order to fashion a cohesive force out of them, but some depots subjected their recruits to particular humiliation. According to veterans interviewed after 1945, recruits were sometimes ordered to clean latrines with a toothbrush, or, apparently an established tradition in the German army, pluck straw out of excrement. There was no recourse to official complaint. Yet soldiers who endured all this seem mainly to have regarded it as hard drill necessary for promoting soldierly discipline. Trainee officers experienced high training standards also. Until 1937, they underwent a 4-year training program. This was then shortened, but its requirements remained strict. The Army also sought to avoid recruiting substandard officer material, relying instead upon correspondingly greater numbers of NCOs. Under the Reichswehr, NCOs had undergone 3.5 years of training. This had created a firm base of high-quality NCOs upon which the new army could now build. The new army itself had to accelerate the NCO production line, and it did so in 2 ways. At the age of 16, Hitler Youth boys spent 2 weeks in barracks on a military preparation camp, where they received lessons in marksmanship with rifles and machine guns. Those who performed most outstandingly could then attend preliminary NCO training. After a year of this, they received another 6 months' training as Obergrenadiere. Alternatively, NCOs could be selected after showing sufficient promise in their first year as a private soldier. In order to attract more recruits to the NCO pool, potential trainees were offered a 5-year service option alongside the already established 12-year option. These truncated procedures did not reduce the quality of NCOs, for the Army also retained the Reichswehr's emphasis on developing aggressive, flexible, and independent thinking in both officers and NCOs, the better to acclimatize them to the demands of Auftragstaktik. In the words of a training directive of October 1940, "Bravery and personal ability are not enough. The younger NCOs who have been proven in war are to be made aware of how they can become leaders, educators, and instructors." The new Truppenführung, Troop Leadership Manual of 1933, had such principles at its heart, stating that unpredictable factors often have decisive influence, and stressing that the commander must act as leader and educator in all situations. How all this translated into practice and the thoroughness of the training that the troops received are exemplified by infantry training. German army training principles during the 1930s maintained that the most important infantry weapon was the machine gun. Until 1942, the German infantry's main machine gun was the MG-34. This weapon was effective on both the offensive and the defensive, and could also bring down aircraft. It had a higher rate of fire than its British equivalent, the Bren. The German army believed that the machine gun, with support from riflemen, was the key to winning firefights. Hence a machine gun, and with it the equivalent firepower of a whole platoon of riflemen, was allotted to every German infantry section. The army's infantry squad tactics, as laid out in the Truppenführung manual, built on older principles of German military training. They stressed flexible and independent-minded thinking, aggression, physical resourcefulness, and the effective use of weaponry. In deploying his squad for combat, the squad leader needed to take rapid note of the surrounding terrain and position his men to exploit fully the available contours and cover. Trees, for instance, made ideal positions for riflemen. The squad leader was also expected rapidly to select the best targets. Infantry training enabled squad leaders to improve this skill by simultaneously presenting flags indicating different potential targets in different locations. By these means, the squad leader and his men gained experience in identifying the most threatening targets. Recruits also practiced full-blown fire and maneuver against serious resistance. Among other things, they were trained to throw grenades while on the move. No detail was neglected. For instance, recruits were also trained to move their bodies tactically, by such means as crawling under cover, going on all fours, or worming on their stomachs and pushing with their feet. So superior were the new army's resources to those of the old Reichswehr that the Truppenführung manual was also able to resurrect the principles of well-provisioned defense in depth. Such techniques had greatly aided the Germans on the Western Front during the First World War. Outposts would be positioned before the forward defense line in order to delay and disrupt the enemy advance. The forward line itself would be the forefront of an in-depth trench system containing obstacles, small dugouts, and nests of individual arms. The troops would make rapid local counterattacks, preferably in the enemy's flanks. Where necessary, they would delay the enemy with resistance, including artillery bombardment, to buy time and cover withdrawal to rear defensive lines. In sum, the troops would employ changing behavior, mobility, speed, surprise, concealment, and other methods of deception, all examples of improvisation emanating from Auftragstaktik. Formidable as this corpus of training and doctrine was, the German infantry of the 1930s did not become a smooth-running machine overnight. For instance, as the Army's 1936 maneuvers showed, troops often failed to distinguish between a fighting withdrawal and an actual retreat. Even so, the quality of the training they were receiving was clear. Two things above all set the German army apart from those opponents it would face during the war's first 2 years: its emphasis on the qualities of Auftragstaktik and its ability consistently to refine and improve its training and doctrine. German armoured warfare techniques were founded on the Army's experience of the stormtroop tactics of the First World War, of the Allies' combined arms offensives of 1918, and of the period of clandestine cooperation between the Reichswehr and the Red Army. The first Panzer Troop School was founded in November 1933. Basic training was the same as the infantry's, together with additional training in anti-tank gunnery. After 6 months, recruits were split into groups for further training as gunners, panzer drivers and mechanics, or signalmen. Exposing panzer recruits to infantry and anti-tank training was one of the ways in which they became proficient in combined arms fighting. Gunnery practice involved various techniques, including firing at moving targets dragged by sledges. Teamwork was even more central for panzers than for infantry. Tank men were trained individually at first, but then the various members of a particular panzer's crew were brought together to operate as a team. Commanders of individual panzers were drawn from the best-trained crews, panzer platoon commanders from the best individual panzer commanders. The new army's first major development in armoured warfare came with the formation of the first four panzer divisions in 1935. Panzer divisions were designed as self-supporting mini-armies based solidly on combined arms principles. They comprised not only panzers, but also motorized infantry, artillery, pioneers, reconnaissance, and a motorized supply column. They were thus well-suited to operating independently and to optimizing those key qualities of initiative, flexibility, and aggression that were at the core of German army doctrine. Once the panzers had broken through the enemy's defense line, motorized infantry and artillery would move up rapidly to form a whole that could withstand enemy counterattack. This force would then regroup, advance, and repeat the process. Over the course of the war, the advantages of the Panzer Division's organization were applied to ever larger groupings, Panzer Corps, Panzer Groups, and eventually Panzer Armies, and to smaller special-purpose Kampfgruppen, battle groups. Replicating the Panzer Division's strength on such a scale increasingly enabled panzer formations not just to break through the enemy's lines, but also to fan out and link up with one another far into the enemy's rear, then encircle and destroy his forces. The new Luftwaffe would be allotted an important supporting role, disrupting the enemy's communications and efforts to get reinforcements up to the line. The new army further refined its armored warfare techniques by continuing the series of large-scale maneuvers that the Reichswehr had begun, only now using the real thing. According to his self-promoting memoirs, Heinz Guderian was not only one of Germany's leading armored warfare generals during the Second World War, but also the key figure in the development of the panzer divisions during the 1930s. Guderian did indeed write several articles for specialist military journals, one of which was used by the general staff itself, and a book on armored warfare tactics, Achtung Panzer, which was widely read following its publication in 1937. But Guderian was also a brazen self-publicist, whose overall contribution to the development of armored warfare, while undoubtedly important, was less epoch-making than he later claimed. In truth, Guderian was only one of several figures who contributed to the development of armored warfare within the German army, and the contributions made by some of these figures were more important than Guderian's. For instance, Colonel Oswald Lutz had assembled the Reichswehr's first makeshift combined arms mechanized force in 1930, a body that had gone on to form the basis of the Reichswehr's Motor Transport Command. He also commanded the 1st Panzer Division to undergo field maneuvers in August 1935. Lutz, now Lieutenant General, was first to recognize that panzers should operate as an aggressive, flexible, independent strike arm. He also believed they should attack the enemy in the flanks and at other weak spots identified at reconnaissance, rather than head-on. And though Guderian and Lutz worked together to develop the panzer force, Lutz was senior and a more effective networker than his temperamental subordinate. Nor was Guderian the only German armored warfare theorist who proposed equipping panzers with radio. Guderian also exaggerated the degree of opposition that thrusting dynamic panzer men, above all himself, faced from stuffy reactionaries at the army's head and within its other branches. The principal Luddite, according to Guderian, was General Beck, who supposedly said to him in 1934, "No, no, I don't want to have anything to do with you people. You move too fast for me." In fact, Beck was no stranger to innovation himself. After all, it was on his watch as Army Chief of Staff that the Truppenführung regulations were issued and the 1st Panzer Divisions established. As for his supposed disdain for armored warfare, in the autumn of 1935 he urged the creation of 48 new panzer battalions. Beck was concerned less about the value of an armored force per se than about its quality if it was expanded too rapidly. He and others also feared that expanding the armored force at breakneck speed would unbalance the entire army and prevent it from integrating that force effectively along sound combined arms principles. There was certainly major disagreement concerning the relationship panzers should have with infantry. In particular, the Truppenführung manual placed high priority on locating and enveloping the enemy's main force, but it saw the panzer's main role as supporting infantry attacks rather than operating as an independent strike force. Indeed, when it came to infantry armor cooperation, German tactics would still be found wanting come the outbreak of war. The mainstays of the early panzer divisions were their Mark I and Mark II light tanks. These were a far cry from the armored colossi of the Second World War's latter years. The particularly diminutive Mark I was equipped with two machine guns and armor only 30 millimeters, half an inch, thick. But the Mark II was a clear improvement. Even though its greater weight hindered cross-country movement, it was faster than the Mark I and also sported a 2-centimeter gun and armor of up to 30 millimeters thick. As the 1930s went on, medium Mark III and IV panzers came into production. These were developed as a compromise between Guderian's preference for a large force of light tanks and the need for heavy models. A major advantage was their ability to upgrade their armor and armament. They would not be mass-produced, however, until the war itself. Production of the Panzer Force and the phases of its technical development from the Mark I's and II's in 1935 through to the colossal Tiger II nearly a decade later were the work of different companies at different times, including Krupp, Henschel, Porsche, and Daimler-Benz. Heading army planning was the new general staff. Modelled on the old Imperial General Staff, it similarly underwent a rigorous, extensive training programme. Yet the programme reflected the weaknesses as well as strengths of German military thinking. Staff officers were immersed in all manner of operational planning, but their schooling in broader matters such as strategy, diplomacy, and logistics was still less thorough than it needed to be. Moreover, officers received only a handful of lectures on military intelligence and no detailed training in intelligence techniques. The army was also having to fight a turf war with the new Wehrmachtsamt, Wehrmacht Office, the renamed Reichswehr Ministry with General von Blomberg at its head. General von Fritsch and General Beck wanted the army to retain a dominant, independent policy role, but Blomberg wanted it brought more firmly under the aegis of the Wehrmachtsamt. Blomberg received ample assistance from numerous army officers, such as Wilhelm Keitel and Alfred Jodl, who had been appointed to work in the Wehrmachtsamt. Once they became ministry men, they went native, undermining efforts to maintain a separate and powerful army command and seeking to subordinate elements of the armed forces to Hitler more directly. The army leadership became mired in this dispute at a time when Reich Marshal Hermann Göring and Grand Admiral Erich Raeder, commanders-in-chief of the Luftwaffe and Kriegsmarine, respectively, were able to gain ever more unfettered access to Hitler. Far from being a parochial dispute, turf wars between the army and central Wehrmacht offices would increasingly debilitate the unity and effectiveness of the high command structure. Between 1933 and 1936, then, the German army leadership took its first largely willing steps down a path of growing subordination to the Nazi regime. It did so largely for political and professional reasons. Regardless of how far many generals shared the Nazis' repugnance of Jews and Bolsheviks, they supported the new regime primarily because of what it offered the army: conscription, rearmament, technological investment, and the mobilization of society. Different parts of this package spoke to different generals in different ways. Guderian's technocratic sensitivities, for instance, were particularly enticed by the third of these. And no one surpassed Blomberg in his enthusiasm for Nazism's apparent potential to mobilize and unify society, as his own courting of the SS showed. But the entire package spoke to the general's vision of an aggrandized army, with the full economic and political backing of the state, restoring Germany's great power status through war. The potency of this vision outweighed the disapproval with which some generals regarded Nazism's rowdier, more radical elements, or the lower middle-class background of the movement's leaders. It also helped to blind generals to the frightening scale of Hitler's own ambitions. The generals' complicity in political murder was the first step in their wider collusion in the regime's crimes. They were also instrumental in indoctrinating the army's vastly augmented manpower from 1935 onwards. This new army was as socially diverse as it was vast. Nevertheless, its new personnel were largely willing to adhere to the ideological, nationalistic agenda the army served. The regime's social and economic policies, its propagandizing and mobilization of German youth, and the appeal of the Volksgemeinschaft and of Hitler himself, all fused with the militaristic attitudes that permeated much of German society. The army's Panzer wing developed, and the army as a whole inherited the superior doctrine and training methods that the Reichswehr had bequeathed. Nevertheless, breakneck expansion brought growing pains, and institutional turf wars and poor strategic grasp limited the effectiveness of the army's highest command levels. All these trends would become more pronounced as war approached during the late 1930s. Chapter 2. The Road to War, 1936 to 1939. The more enemies, the more honor. This was General von Blomberg's riposte to worries that Germany's rapid rearmament would antagonize foreign nations. It was a particularly guileless statement, even by his standards. Between 1936 and 1939, the massive rearmament drive ordered by Hitler and lauded by the Wehrmacht had equally massive destabilizing effects upon Germany's economy, the international diplomatic system, and the international military balance. The result was a major war of a kind that Germany had not expected to fight so soon, and for which it was not fully prepared. Many senior officers were concerned at the pace of events, but some were more concerned than others, and none took effective united action to slow or halt it. But this is unsurprising, given the alacrity with which the army became further subjugated to the Nazi regime during this time. The pressures spawned by rearmament cast an ever darker shadow over the whole period, and it is worth briefly surveying those pressures before examining the German army's role in the path to war more closely. From 1935, rearmament soaked up the great majority of the Nazi regime's re-employment efforts, and this made increasing demands upon the German economy. In 1932, 8 million citizens of Weimar Germany were unemployed. Between then and 1934, the last Weimar governments and then the Nazis themselves sought to boost employment through public works schemes. Most of these were non-military in nature. Rearmament itself was slow to commence because the infrastructure of rearmament, including bases and barracks, had to be created first. But from 1935, rearmament and schemes to build public works with a military use, such as the new Autobahnen, were Hitler's favoured means of continuing to drive down unemployment, favoured, of course, because they corresponded to his warlike ambitions. In focusing so predominantly on preparation for war, the German economy faced two particular problems. Firstly, it was heavily dependent upon international resources. Secondly, it was faced with trying to reconcile the rearmament drive with German civilians' need for foodstuffs and consumer goods. This guns versus butter problem heavily preoccupied the regime during the 1930s. The satirical British magazine Punch lampooned the Nazis' dilemma in June 1937. It published a cartoon of Hitler training a Dachshund dressed as a soldier to resist food. The dog balances a lump of fat on his nose while balancing his own body on a munition shell. Trust is the cartoon's title. Yes, but I've been trusting such a long time, retorts the dog. These twin dangers threatened to suck in imports to an extent that could precipitate a balance of payments crisis, sparking runaway inflation and potentially destroying public support for the regime. In order to sustain such a massive rearmament drive, then, the Nazi regime needed a resource base large enough to enable it to satisfy the needs of both rearmament and the civilian population. Ultimately, it would find that it could only secure such a resource base by embarking upon foreign conquests even sooner. Yet the economic dilemma it faced was still not enough on its own to compel Germany into war as early as 1939. For the regime was able to employ various measures to ease its predicament, or at least stave off the point at which it might grow critical. At no time between 1933 and 1939 did the German people suffer economic hardships anything like as bad as those they had endured between 1929 and 1932. Agricultural reforms and selective rationing sustained Germany's food supply, and welfare payments further dampened the potential for unrest. The Nazis introduced wage and price controls to manage inflation, and the apparatus of state terror suppressed remaining discord. The quarter from which the Nazis might have expected the most social trouble was the industrialized working class. Yet strict work regulations, the destruction of the trade unions, the efficacy of the Kraft durch Freude, strength through joy organization, or KDF, and Nazi propaganda's appeal to anti-Semitism and working-class patriotism all helped to stifle potential working-class dissent. In October 1936, moreover, Hitler introduced the four-year plan, a drive for economic self-sufficiency designed to make Germany less reliant upon imports. Yet though all these measures might go some way to counteracting the mounting pressures upon the German economy, there was a limit to what they could do in the long term. For the pressures themselves intensified as a result of the international arms race precipitated by the rearmament and expansion not only of Nazi Germany, but also of fascist Italy and Imperial Japan. Both countries were not only governed, like Germany, by aggressive militaristic regimes. In the wake of the economic crisis of the early 1930s, they believed that conquering foreign territory and resources would make them economically self-sufficient and immune to the ill winds of the global economy. As a result, all of Germany's major potential opponents in a future war, Great Britain, France, the Soviet Union, and the United States, began to raise military spending as the 1930s went on. As far as Hitler was concerned, Germany could not risk losing ground in the arms race it had helped precipitate, and the pressure to keep pace intensified the very same economic and political problems that the Nazi regime was seeking to ease. As a result, Hitler injected an ever greater element of risk into his foreign policy. He accelerated its timetable to seize more territory and resources, further escalating international tensions in the process. This made a general European war likely sooner rather than later, when neither the Reich nor the German army was fully prepared for it. In March 1936, Germany's stock of foreign raw materials and grain dwindled to perilously low levels. That same month, Hitler took radical action to try to ease the economic pressure. His focus was on the region of Germany west of the River Rhine. The Rhineland had been demilitarized under the terms of the Treaty of Versailles, with Germany forbidden to call up recruits or keep troops there, and restricted as to what types of weaponry it could produce there. Ending these restrictions by fully reincorporating the Rhineland into Germany had always been a long-term aim of Hitler's, as indeed it would have been for any interwar German government, since it would help secure Germany's western frontier in the event of war. Hitler's decision to remilitarize the Rhineland quickly was prompted by the growing pressures on the economy, and, if the SD's regular morale reports are to be believed, by the effect that stagnating living standards were having upon public opinion. Not only would remilitarizing the Rhineland provide a foreign policy boost to the regime's popularity, it would also free up the Rhineland's industrial capacity for arms production. Hitler also moved when he did because of the opportunities the international situation presented. Hitler and the army leadership were aware, as Britain and France would have been aware had they intervened, that the German army was still far from ready for war. But Hitler gambled, if not all that recklessly, that the British and French governments would be too distracted by other problems, both domestic and international, to intervene. Above all, Hitler knew that the British and French were currently preoccupied with fascist Italy's recent invasion of Abyssinia in East Africa. With the United States pursuing a policy of international isolation, Britain and France were the leading lights in the League of Nations, the worthy but toothless arbiter of international disputes that had been founded after the First World War. The League's condemnation of the invasion had turned Italy away from Britain and France, thus making her unlikely to support either of them in a stand against Germany. Hitler's judgment proved correct. When German troops marched in, their apparent numbers swelled by clever editing of the Nazi propaganda newsreels, Britain and France did indeed stop short of intervention. Hitler's success in reoccupying the Rhineland buttressed the Nazi regime's domestic popularity, and the passive British and French response emboldened him further. Among other things, he now became less inclined to heed any general who might counsel caution over Germany's lack of military preparedness against Britain and France. He noted Fritsch and Beck's opposition to the Rhineland operation. Among other things, they had scorned the idea of disguising the troops' movements as SA and RAD exercises. He also noted the distinct lack of nerve Blomberg had displayed during the operation's more tense moments, later accusing the Wehrmacht commander-in-chief of behaving like a hysterical old maid. But Britain and France's inaction over the Rhineland brought no let-up in their own rearmament efforts. In August 1936, for instance, the government in Paris approved a 14 billion franc program to expand the French army. The Wehrmacht reacted by making further demands on the German economy. In June 1936, for instance, the army called for enough infrastructure and equipment to support a field army of over 100 divisions and 3.5 million men by the autumn of 1940. It also called for the establishment of three new 500-strong panzer divisions, in addition to the three founded in October 1935, and four motorized divisions and three light divisions of more than 200 armored fighting vehicles apiece. Fulfilling demands for weaponry of such a patently offensive nature could only alarm foreign governments further and provoke them into rearming even faster. Moreover, producing all this war material would mean retooling many German factories and also building many new ones. Furthermore, once such factories were geared towards producing armaments, they would need to keep receiving huge follow-on orders in order to maintain war readiness. The only alternative would be to convert them to civilian production, but that risked creating huge unemployment and delaying their reconversion once war actually broke out. Thus did Germany's rearmament drive generate a further self-reinforcing momentum. In October 1936, as the arms race and its challenges intensified further, Hitler appointed Hermann Göring as head of the Office of the Four-Year Plan. The latter's purpose was to make Germany less reliant on foreign exchange and more economically self-sufficient. Above all, Hitler declared that the Wehrmacht must be operational within 4 years and the German economy